This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Close to one out of five Americans are of Latino or Hispanic background. But if you look at the movies, at television, at books, even the news, you might guess it was one out of 10 or 20. Latinos rarely get the leading role, the anchor job, the op-ed column. And Latino narratives are seriously underrepresented. That's true just about everywhere. And publishers and leading editors, myself very much included, need to listen and do a lot better. Representative Joaquin Castro of Texas and other members of Congress asked the Government Accountability Office for a report on Latino representation. It was released last week, and the results are pretty damning. So the lawmakers are looking at what the government can do about this kind of exclusion. Joaquin Castro spoke with the New Yorker's Stefania Tulladreed.
Congressman, we're here to talk about an issue that you've been fighting for over the years, and that is the missing Latino narrative in our society. To begin with, I'd like us to talk about education, which one could argue is really at the heart of it. You grew up in San Antonio, a city that has an incredibly rich Latino heritage. And yet it seems like Latino stories were barely present in your school's curriculum. So take us back in time, if you will. Who are the Latinos you remember learning about, and how did you fill that void in the narrative over the years?
I see this as a foundational problem for the Latino community and other communities in the United States, that we have been left out of much of the telling of American history and our state histories, including in my home state of Texas. And so when I was growing up, the only Latinos, in this case, mostly Mexican Americans, that I remember, or Mexicans actually, that I remember learning about were the defenders of the Alamo. And really not much else. Maybe Henry Cisneros, who was mayor of San Antonio when I was in school. But it was a very sparse presence in the telling of American history and Texas history. And that's in a state that's now nearly 40% Latino.
You have two children who, if I'm not mistaken, are 5 and 7. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
How does their experience in school so far compare to yours? What are you seeing now with the new generations?
Well, they're in second grade and kindergarten, so they still haven't gotten to the heart of the courses in history where you would learn about different figures. But we're still not at a place where you have representation that's commensurate in a state like Texas with the huge Latino role in terms of the economy of the state, the culture of the state, and how meaningful Latinos have been to the development of Texas. And I'm convinced that Americans don't know who Latinos are. They don't associate us with any particular time period in American history. They don't know who among us has contributed to the nation's prosperity or success. And they have no sense where to place us within American society.
And of course, schools are important narrative-creating institutions, but they're not the only ones. There's Hollywood, there's the news media, corporate America, the government, so on and so forth. And it's no secret that there's little Latino representation across the board. I remember after last year's election, Latino Victory reported that only 1% of local and federal elected officials were Latino. I suspect that that number is slightly higher now, but not nearly where it should be, considering that there's more than 60 million of us in this country and that we now represent the largest minority voting group. And I wonder, as one of the few and really most influential Latino politicians in the country, what are some of the challenges you faced in raising the issue of representation in the news media, in Hollywood and beyond, and demanding more accountability from Washington?
Well, in addition to the influences that you mentioned about education, I think media, and particularly Hollywood, I think is the main image-defining and narrative-creating institution in American society. In the way that it tells stories and whose stories get told and who it allows to be part of the storytelling, it affects how Americans see each other, including how Americans see Latinos and how we see ourselves. And the numbers in terms of representation and portrayal of Latinos, the numbers in terms of representation are terrible in the media industry, and whether it's Hollywood or hard news. For example, in entertainment, Latinos make up around 3 and 4% of folks in front of and behind the camera. And that affects the stories that come out of Hollywood and how they're told. And oftentimes it's led to very negative portrayals and stereotypes. Latinos as always as drug dealers, as criminals, as the dregs of society, as illegals. And it affects how other Americans see our community and how our own children see themselves. And part of the reason that I got involved in this issue is because there has been now for several years, at least, this dangerous nexus between representation, portrayal, and the abuse of Latino stereotypes that come out of the media, the abuse of those by politicians who abuse them for their own political gain. And in that dangerous mix, in its worst form, you get what happened in El Paso, Texas, in August of 2019, where a madman drove 10 hours and killed 23 people because he considered them, quote unquote, Hispanic invaders to Texas. And so all of this represents for me a very dangerous void in narrative. And it really came to a head in May of 2020 when the Congressional Hispanic Caucus had a meeting with publishing executives. And there were about 30 of us on the call. And I had a chance to ask a question of one of the CEOs of one of the largest publishing companies in the country that publishes textbooks for schools. And I asked him a very simple question. I asked him whether he could name three Latinos or Latinas who had had a significant impact in American history. And this very intelligent, ambitious, accomplished man thought about it for a few seconds, and he finally said, no, I can't. He wasn't meaning to be rude to me. He wasn't dismissing me. We were having an earnest discussion, all of us. But I think the unfortunate thing is that if you ask that question, I'm convinced of 90% of Americans, you would probably get the same answer.
Tell us about the two reports on the underrepresentation of Latinos that the Government Accountability Office will issue. Can you share any of its main findings with us?
Yeah, I mean, we've just gotten a preliminary sketch of what their overall findings will show, but it's clear in the title of their report that Latinos are underrepresented in American media and that there has been almost no change since 2014. And where you do have more of a concentration of Latinos, it's in service sector positions within the media industry, rather than as anchors, for example, or as directors in film or television. And so it remains deeply problematic, this challenge of American media really committing to change. And the irony about some of it is that Hollywood, for example, considers it, and I think most Americans consider it, a liberal place and a liberal industry. But there's a central irony there. I think there are individuals in Hollywood who are individually progressive, but the system as a whole is actually quite regressive and pretty conservative. And Hollywood is actually very exclusionary. In fact, at least from the data I've seen, Hollywood is less diverse than the oil and gas industry in Texas.
And what can we expect from the report that will come out in the spring of next year? What's the difference between both? What will you be looking at?
This is kind of what they've released so far, a thumbnail sketch, but it's going to go into much more depth in individual media parts, in print media, in entertainment, in broadcast media. And so I'm looking forward to that much more comprehensive report, and also to making the connection about how Congress and people in government can take a more active role in helping to change and move the media industry along. You know, this is an industry that benefits incredibly from different kinds of tax breaks in, you know, production tax credits in states like California and New Mexico and Georgia. And so I pose the question as a policymaker, at what point, if I represent a constituency, for example, in San Antonio, that is 64% Latino, at what point, if an industry comes forward to me and asks for a tax break, in whatever form it may take, a tax credit, tax incentive, at what point do I have to look at that industry and say, you know, I've got a population that's 64% of a group that you're basically excluding from participating in your industry? Why in the world would I ask the people I represent to subsidize their own exclusion by giving you a tax break? And so we've been working with the National Hispanic State Legislators and others to get state legislators and members of Congress and really elected officials across the board to get them more aware of what's going on in the industry so that they can be more discerning when the media industry, mostly Hollywood, but other components of the media industry, come forward and ask for tax breaks from their constituents.
And it is my understanding that both Illinois and New Jersey are already doing that. In other words, they've kind of found a way to effectively tie tax incentives to workplace diversity, which is a big challenge, right? But at the end of the day, as you pointed out, underrepresentation comes with a cost. I mean, I remember seeing this report that UCLA put together, the Hollywood Diversity Report, and they found that more diverse casts did not only earn more at the box office, they also generated larger streaming audiences, right? And so in addition to the importance of data, accountability, transparency, and the way those can lead to change, as you pointed out, I think there are also very important incentives that ought to be addressed. And
no, that's absolutely right. And I think there's a few oddities here. The one, as you mentioned, is that it's been shown now on many occasions that more diverse casts actually lead to greater box office success. And so you would think that the streamers and the traditional broadcasters and the cable companies, they would all move in that direction. And it's happening, but it's happened pretty slowly, and especially slowly for Latinos. And then the second piece of that is that usually when you're excluded from something, it's because by a company, it's because they make the argument that you really aren't their market. In other words, you aren't the people buying their thing. Well, what's weird here is that it's actually the exact opposite. Latinos over-index as purchasers of movie tickets, this pandemic period obviously notwithstanding, and also over-index as social media consumers and as streaming consumers. So you would think that all the incentives are there for the companies, both on the success of diversity films and television and streaming projects, and then also in terms of their existing consumers. You would think that the forces, the incentives are there for them to actually change, but it hasn't happened the way you would expect it to.
Representative Joaquin Castro represents the 20th Congressional District of Texas. And you can read Stefania Teledrede on politics in the U.S. and in Latin America, Spain, and much more at NewYorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The United Nations climate meeting in Glasgow, which starts on October 31st, is described as the most important since the Paris Agreement was adopted in 2015. We could see major policy announcements from the Biden administration or governments from around the world. But the summer we've just had, with its appalling wildfires and its record floods, provides ample evidence that the effects of climate change are already here, and they're catastrophic. And frankly, nothing that governments are likely to do this year will be enough to reverse those trends. Andreas Malm is a professor at Lund University in Sweden. He studies the relationship between climate change and capitalism, and he advocates for far more drastic action than we've seen so far. His recent book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, is a bit more nuanced than the title suggests, but at its core, he really does want environmental activists to rethink their commitment to nonviolence and embrace tactics of sabotage. I spoke with Andreas Malm last week. Andreas, you've been a climate activist now for a long time, and in 2007, you were part of a Swedish group that started deflating the tires on SUVs. Tell me about that. What was the impulse, and how did it work?
Yeah, so what we did was we went through rich neighborhoods and picked out SUVs. This was in the early career of SUVs when they were still remarkable on streets before they had become completely ubiquitous. And it's very easy to deflate the tires of a car. You just unscrew the valve and you insert a little gravel or a piece of stone or something like that, and you screw the valve back on, and then the air will be out of the tire in a couple of hours. So this was not property destruction. It didn't damage anything. It created an inconvenience for the owners of SUVs.
What was the result of this action? Were there arrests? Did anybody do jail time?
There was eventually one arrest, but that was after thousands of SUVs had been deflated in this manner.
And did that cause consciousness about SUVs to change in Sweden? And did sales go down?
Sales went down quite sharply. And we took credit for that. I mean, I don't know if you could scientifically establish that our actions were the cause of that plunge in sales that happened during that year. You know, there have been, over the past decades, there have been those moments when climate has been on the top of the political agenda. And this was one of those moments. There was the fourth IPCC report that received the Nobel Peace Prize. There was the movie by Al Gore. There was the run-up to Copenhagen. And in this setting, our actions probably contributed to decreasing sales of SUVs.
Now, you've gone from deflating tires to writing a book now in 2021 called How to Blow Up a Pipeline. What was the moment that you realized that your next book would have to be about targeted sabotage, and why?
That moment was very much the summer of 2018, which was unprecedented in Northern Europe for the wildfires and the drought and the heat wave. And during that summer, I felt panic and desperation, as a lot of people did. This was the summer that led Greta Thunberg to start her later very famous school strike movement. And that sort of changed the picture, because in 2019, all the way up to the outbreak of the pandemic, the climate movement in the global north reached its zenith of mobilization, really its peak of popular force out on the streets. So the book became a product of the moment of 2019, but it's also a call for escalation, a call for the movement to diversify its tactics and move away from an exclusive focus on polite, gentle, and perfectly peaceful civil disobedience.
What actions are you recommending for the movement?
Well, I am recommending that the movement continues with mass action and civil disobedience, but also opens up for property destruction. So I'm not saying we should stop strikes or square occupations or demonstrations of the usual kind. I'm all in favor of that. But I do think we need to step up, because so little has changed and so many investments are still being poured into new fossil fuel projects. So I am in favor of destroying machines, property, not harming people. That's a very, very important distinction there. And I think property can be destroyed in all manner of ways, or it can be neutralized in a very gentle fashion, as when we deflated the SUVs, or in a more spectacular fashion, as in potentially blowing up a pipeline that's under construction. That's something that people have done.
So you are recommending blowing up a pipeline. You use the phrase intelligent sabotage. What is What does intelligence sabotage look like in this context?
Well, let me give you a very concrete example. Right now, Total, the largest single private company headquartered in France, is constructing what will be the world's longest heated oil pipeline in Uganda and Tanzania, and displacing in that process about 100,000 farmers, all for the sake of carrying even more oil to the world market to pour fuel on the global fire. If people in that region were to attack the construction equipment, blow up the pipeline before it's completed, I would be all in favor of that. I don't see how that property damage could be considered morally illegitimate, given what we know of the consequences of such a project.
Do you yourself plan to be involved in such actions?
Well, if I were planning things, I wouldn't tell you or anyone else. That's part of the whole idea of this kind of things. You don't say in advance what you're going to do if you plan to do something. But I'm personally, in principle, prepared to, of course, to be part of any kind of action of the sort that I advocate in the book. Anything else would be irresponsible.
Andreas, you argue that these are tactics that have worked in the past. One example that you point to in your book is when Nigerian activists, fighting the devastating effects of oil production in the country in the early 2000s, took real action. Tell me about that and how effective it was.
They blew up pipelines. They destroyed infrastructure. They went so far as to kidnap oil workers, something that I certainly wouldn't recommend. And they were successful at a particular moment when it seemed that the major oil companies like Shell and ExxonMobil were on the verge of quitting the area. Then repression kicked in, many activists were jailed, and obviously oil production is still ongoing in the Niger Delta. So you can say that that is a case of successful termination of oil production, certainly not. I bring that up as one case among many others that show that property damage is technically feasible. Another very recent example is these anonymous hackers who brought the Colonial Pipeline in the U.S., the largest pipeline in the U.S., to a complete standstill by hacking the computers. This was about a half year ago, I believe. And that pipeline didn't convey any gas for a week. But given the magnitude of the climate threat, the paradox here is that people have not engaged in this with reference to the climate crisis. How is it that the planet is on fire, almost literally, you know, wildfires moving from one country to the other. It's underwater with floods and storms like you saw in New York just the other week. And continuous production of new installations for fossil fuel extraction is totally normalized and it's happening all over the place. And people don't rise up when they know, at some level at least, they know that if these sources are not closed down, we will have more and more of the wildfires, we'll have more and more of the droughts, more and more heat waves, more and more floods, until we can live no longer.
And yet climate activist groups like 350.org and Extinction Rebellion have made clear that nonviolence is central to their approach. Do you think that's been a mistake or a tactical error?
Yeah, so I have nothing against the tactics employed by these groups. I have very often participated in them myself. What I have a problem with is when Extinction Rebellion and people from 350 and elsewhere say that these are the only things that our movement can ever allow itself to engage in. As in, what we are doing is as far as we will ever go. We'll never escalate beyond this. And I think that idea, this dogmatic commitment to nonviolence, is based on a faulty history writing or understanding of social struggles over history, because it's based on the idea that the only thing that has ever worked for social movements is to stay completely peaceful. And that just isn't the case. Most social movements that have struggled against overwhelming odds, against enemies that have been very powerful, have diversified and used a number of different tactics, ranging into property destruction and confrontation with the police. You saw this during the uprising after the murder of George Floyd, where there was tremendous property destruction and conquering and burning down police stations in Minneapolis and things like that. That was an integral part of an uprising that brought more millions of people into the streets of the U.S. than any other in American history.
But Andreas, the overwhelming number of people in the demonstrations following the murder of George Floyd were nonviolent.
Peaceful. Of course.
And in fact, some scholars, some activists made the argument that in fact the small minority, the instances of violence or property destruction was a hindrance, was alienating in terms of public opinion. How do you argue with that?
Well, I think that is a faulty reading of what happened, because to my understanding, what really kicked off that uprising and took it to another scale were the events 3 days after the murder of Floyd, when the good people of Minneapolis stormed the police station in the 3rd Precinct where Derek Chauvin and his colleagues had been based. And as far as I can tell, that was a catalyst for the movement. And contrary to the ideas of strategic pacifism, it went hand in hand with an overwhelming majority of peaceful activities, just as you say. Of course, there was always a tension between militant groups and the peaceful majorities, as it usually is the case. But I don't think that anyone could seriously argue that the BLM movement in 2020 would have achieved more if there had been no confrontations, no windows smashed, no police stations or cars burnt. That's a fantasy scenario, in my view.
You used the analogy with the civil rights movement in the United States,
yeah.
the tension between the broader nonviolent movement of SNCC and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and
yeah.
Martin Luther King, and then on the other hand, other groups. So how do you analogize those things with the climate movement?
Yeah, so the idea from that case is that there was a so-called radical flank effect, that the existence of a radical flank of the civil rights movement and a sort of threat of a more militant wing, as in Malcolm X, the urban riots and things like that, actually worked to the strategic advantage of the civil rights mainstream, because it allowed it to say to the powers that be in Washington that unless you make a deal with us, you'll end up with these people who are much more radical than we are.
Here's what somebody like Bill McKibben would say, and I know you've had your debates with him. As dire as things are for the climate,
yeah,
it's not like the movement hasn't accomplished anything. Pipelines have been shut down peacefully.
Sure.
Legislation passed. Over 6 million people got involved with Greta Thunberg's climate strikes in 2019. How concerned are you that engaging with more militant tactics could backfire and damage the movement?
Of course it could. Of course it could. I mean, if people started doing really stupid things, as in killing people, you know, I don't know, assassinating CEOs or something like that, then certainly the backlash would be overwhelming. So that's why I think we need to continue to draw a very sharp line against that type of violence. And you're absolutely right that everything that the movement has accomplished so far has been on the basis of nonviolence, because that's the only strategy we have used. But our victories have been very local and very partial. We in the movement certainly haven't brought fossil fuel production to a stop as we have to.
Andreas, Ezra Klein, New York Times columnist, wrote a piece about your book and the financial fallout from pipeline sabotage potentially.
Yeah.
He
yeah.
writes this: the consequence of a wave of bombings to obliterate energy infrastructure would be to raise the price on energy immediately all across the world, and the burdens would fall heaviest on the poor. Is he wrong?
Yeah, so on the argument that there would be economic pain from property destruction, yeah, of course there is that risk. The problem here is, first of all, that any kind of phasing out of fossil fuel production and consumption will trigger price spikes. It's very difficult to see us getting rid of fossil fuels without them becoming more expensive. So advocating a strategy that doesn't make energy more expensive is almost tantamount, fossil energy more expensive is almost tantamount to not advocating mitigation at all. And of course, if you engage in property destruction that causes such disruption to prices, you run a risk of alienating people. But I think that if people go about this in a careful fashion, and if they time property destruction of this sort to moments when the impacts of the climate crisis are being felt, there would be a decent chance to also gain popular support for these kind of actions.
One of the things that would mitigate against that, unfortunately, is that we live in a world of Fox News. And if they were to see activists on the left going after private property in the name of climate change, I think you can write the script. The next thing you know, you'd have blaring headlines about eco-terrorism. So how do you avoid playing into the eco-terrorism narrative, or can you?
Yeah. Well, I don't think that we should adapt our tactics after the enemy's script. If the protesters after the murder of George Floyd would have done so, they certainly would have stayed home. Because, of course, what Fox told the viewers was that BLM was a terrorist Marxist movement. If you challenge vested interests, you will face that kind of backlash. Whether you challenge them peacefully or you challenge them through property destruction, you will certainly get demonization from the far right. That's already happening. But I do think that at some point, I mean, if there's any rationality in the human species left, then people in moments when they see their habitats, their ecosystems around them disappearing and their lives becoming unbearable, if in that moment you have climate activists who strike against the sources of all this pain and suffering, then at least some segments of the population should presumably support that. If not now, then maybe when it's 2 degrees or 3 degrees hotter. But the task for the climate movement isn't to wait until it's extremely late, which it already is, but to move ahead and to use opportunities of extreme climate disaster, which are raining upon us, to drive this point home to people. We can't have more fossil fuel infrastructure and a habitable planet at the same time. We need to choose one or the other.
Let's take sabotage off the table for a second.
Yes.
Is there a way that the movement could be smarter in the way that it engages in nonviolent protest?
Yes. I think nonviolent protest works best when it targets fossil fuel production. When you have nonviolent mass actions that close down traffic in general, squares in general, in cities, it's a kind of indiscriminate targeting of urban activity that isn't necessarily the best. I think it makes much more sense to have things like climate camps, where you have people peacefully breaking through police lines, shutting down gas pipelines or coal mines, that's usually the case in the German climate camps, shutting this infrastructure down, if only for a couple of days. That's a very effective way of getting people together in action and openly targeting the source of the problem.
Finally, we are coming up on major climate talks in Glasgow, and what John Kerry has described is the last best hope for international action on this. Are you feeling any hope about these talks, and what would be a good outcome from them?
To be honest, I have no hope about those talks. This is the 26th COP. I'm sure I'll be able to, if I live, join my kids to COP 52 down the road if things continue like this, because these COPs have produced nothing apart from complete business as usual. I do have some hope that the protests at Glasgow can reinvigorate the climate movement, because it's been in something like a coma after the pandemic broke out, and it hasn't regained the momentum from 2019.
Do you expect any acts of sabotage at Glasgow?
I don't expect any, but I would certainly hope for a more militant edge at the COP26 protests than what we've seen at any other COP protest so far. I mean, my faith in humanity would certainly be reinforced if there was real anger on the streets of Glasgow, given the state of this planet and what capital is doing to just worsen the situation all the time.
Andreas Malm, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Andreas Malm is an associate professor at Lund University in Sweden. His book is called How to Blow Up a Pipeline. From the earliest days of this program, we've been covering the issue of climate change and how it's affecting our lives, our economies, and our futures. Some years ago, our reporter, Carolyn Corman, went to Tangier Island in the Chesapeake Bay off the coast of Virginia. Tangier Island has been losing landmass for years, and as sea levels rise, it may be one of the first places in the United States to become absolutely uninhabitable. Although, when Carolyn visited, sea level rise itself was a fact that many on Tangier Island refused to accept, including the mayor.
How much of your day every day do you think you spend considering the weather?
Probably 60% of it. Weather is our life.
Eskridge is showing us around his crab shanty. He's got dozens of blue crabs in tanks out here.
We bring the peeler crabs in and we dump them in these tanks. That's what my father used to do and grandfather before him.
He's waiting for them to molt so he can sell them as soft shell crabs, Tangier's specialty.
Oh, this one's shedding right now, and so's that one, right?
Yep. They're called busters.
Who's this?
This is Sam Alito.
He looks like a stately old gentleman.
Yeah.
The mayor's also got cats out at the shanty.
We were having a tropical system, and there was a tree stump drifting in the storm, and there was four kittens hanging onto it. I guess they came from the island, but I went out and picked them up, and they've been here ever since. And they're a conservative group. It's Sam Alito and John Roberts, Condi Rice, and Ann Coulter.
He's been working from this spot since he graduated from high school in 1976. The building is about the size of a one-car garage, and it's perched on pilings in the harbor. He points to those pilings and says the high water mark is right where it's always been. And that's why he doesn't believe that climate change is causing the sea level to rise.
We've had people coming for years about the erosion problem here. I had a lady that told me, Mayor, whether you believe in climate change and sea level rise or not, go along with it because you may get funding to save your island.
Who told you that?
Some lady. Some lady told me. She, you know, just visiting. She was in the government. That's all I'm going to say about that. She said, go along with it. Go along with it, and you may get the funding you need because that's the argument of today. And after I did a couple interviews after that, and I would mention sea level rise and climate change in it, and I felt real dirty inside. So I stopped doing it. I said, I can't do it. I don't believe it. I can't do it.
You can find that story and everything we've aired on the program on our podcast. Look for the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you go for podcast. We've got much more to come this hour, so stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Parul Segal is a book critic and an essayist. And very recently, she came to The New Yorker from The New York Times. She's at work now on her very first piece for us, and I called her up recently to find out what she's been reading and what she's thinking about. Par, welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you bet. Now, in addition to working at The New Yorker, you're also teaching a graduate class at New York University, and you're going to give us a little taste of the syllabus. And my understanding is that the name of the course is Writing the Unspeakable. What does that mean?
It's Writing the Unspeakable because when you work with language or with narrative, invariably you become interested in where it breaks down. You know, where is it insufficient? And so these are all books that are about atrocities, some personal, some political, but we're very interested in thinking about what forms have been developed historically, what forms are being developed now to talk about them.
So let's start with your first pick in this syllabus of The Unspeakable.
Perhaps let's choose the work that is, in a way, the most inaccessible. It's a one-woman show that premiered in 1999. It's called 2.5 Minute Ride by Lisa Crone. So you can get the script, and I've assigned the script, and we listen to, you can get a recording on Audible. And this one-woman play, a woman is going to walk to the front of the stage, and she's going to start putting on like a slideshow, like the way the old vacation slides, like this is where we went. But she's going to show you two separate journeys. One is a trip she took with her father to Auschwitz, where his parents were killed. The second journey she describes, flipping through these slides, is her father's late in life obsession. Her father had a heart condition, was a diabetic, was blind, and became obsessed with roller coasters. And so she flips through amusement parks and Auschwitz. It just gives you whiplash. And you're laughing one minute, you're appalled. You don't know what's happening. You don't have time to assimilate it. Also, keep in mind that the slides she's showing everyone are blank.
This is a picture of my dad on a roller coaster. This is a picture of my parents having dinner at the Olive Garden at the mall, which is directly across Saginaw Highway from Myers. This is a picture of my dad getting an insulin shot. This is a picture of me not being able to hold his world in my head. This is a picture of my father's funeral, which is odd because my father is still alive.
And one, she's sort of describing, obviously, trauma in the everyday. And secondly, I think she's asking this really interesting question of how can I tell this story without my father's suffering and the suffering of his parents, that it's not just a trinket. It's not something easily consumed you can take home after coming to this show.
Does it seem to outrage people? I mean, there's something in people's reaction to certain kinds of literature, particularly Holocaust literature, that it's sanctified in a way. And to betray that with comedy or the perverse, no matter who the author is, often gets a terribly negative reaction.
It can, but I think that so many people have had the experience I've had listening to my own family's history of escaping partition with some of the most inappropriate jokes known to man.
Yeah.
And the flip side of horror and humor is very, very real. But yeah, I think it's also about, you know, really struggling with the idea of some traumas being hyper-represented, right? So what story can she tell? And she really struggles with this in the play. She stops at one point and she sort of scans the audience and she goes, you've seen Schindler's List, you know this. There's nothing I'm showing you that you haven't seen. And what kind of room is left for her story, for more stories?
So let's move from Lisa Crone to your next pick.
My next pick is Christina Sharpe's book, In the Wake, on Blackness and Being. And it's a book about its subject, but it's also so deeply a book about thinking. And it's one of those books that when you first read them, they gave you extra senses. So some of the ways I think about this book were given to me by this book.
We'll start with who Christina Sharpe is. Who is that, Parle?
She's a scholar. Right now, I think she's at York University in Toronto. And she begins this book talking about a number of deaths that have happened in her family, some very mysterious, and opens up to talk about what historian Sadie Hartman calls the afterlives of slavery, the way that slavery's life is still inscribed in the present in incarceration, impoverishment, access to healthcare. It's the sort of present-day haunting, right? We're not shaken of it. And what Sharp wants to do in this book, using the metaphors of the slave ship, right? The metaphor of the hold, where enslaved people were kept, the metaphor of the wake, the watery trail behind a ship, is to describe blackness and slavery in its current forms. How do we look at photographs? How do we look at the past? So let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things she does is she looks at a photograph that was, I think it was like an AP photograph of a young girl following an earthquake in Haiti. The girl is lying, I think, on the ground or on a gurney of some sort, and she has a tape on her forehead that says ship. So she wants to look at how this news photograph, right, this photograph that was taken and disseminated, what are the premises of this photograph? Who does this photograph assume is looking at it? How can we look at this photograph and be with the subject, right? Not make her a specimen again. So she asks these questions of photographs, of news articles, about migrants, about Eric Garner, about any number of things, to just sort of say, how are these stories being told? And how can we, if possible, show care as writers and as readers for some of these events?
Well, finally, we come to a writer from Belarus, and I interviewed her for this program some time ago. It's Svetlana Alexievich. And she won the Nobel Prize, I think, in 2015. But I haven't read the book that's on your pick three list. So could you tell us about that?
Right. So I'm recommending her first book, a book that I really admire because it has, you know, big first book energy, which is sort of, you feel her. See, humor and horror have to go together a little bit. I'm sorry. But what you experience in the book is a writer kind of exhilarated to be finding a form to say, I think this is how I'm going to do it. This is how it's going to be done. And what's going to be done is a different way of writing history. The book is about some of the 1 million women who fought in the Red Army during World War II. And she wanted to tell a history from the inside, which is to sort of say, I want to tell a story, a history of emotions. Emotions are a kind of reality. And I want to tell a story of this war from the perspective of the women. She says it has its own logic, it has its own color, it has its own smell. There's a real intimacy in this particular book. You know, she describes growing up in Minsk and being surrounded by widows, right? And always knowing how to talk to widows, all these women who their husbands had been killed. And so she wanted to talk to these women again, and they're much older. And she interviews up to like 500 people for these books. And she would go to their houses and she would drink tea and they would try on clothes and she would wait for the story. And then some of the stories that would come out, they're not what you expect. I think that's also part of it, right? Like the word pretty occurs a lot in this book. The word unkissed shows up a lot. These were really young women. Some of them were 20, barely 20. And what they write about is curling their hair with pine cones in a forest and coming back at the age of 20 and feeling ancient. They write about how difficult it is to love or be loved, to touch. She got into a lot of trouble. Censors kept saying, well, this is not history. I mean, and she kept saying, like, no, it's in these details. This is the story I want to tell, the story of the insanity of what they lived through.
It's interesting to me, Paul, that one instruction of modesty for journalists is that no matter how good your reporting and even your insight, you're never going to get as deep as fiction can go into the human well of emotions and understanding. And yet the books that you've picked here are either some form of memoir or nonfiction, and they go as deep as is conceivable to go.
They do. They try to. And sometimes they go so deep because they also sometimes don't go all the way into the abyss. They talk about what can't be represented. 2.5-minute ride is really beautiful because she tells you, I'm going to tell you all my father's stories. But what does she really tell us? She keeps a lot of privacy for him, you know? So there's certain things that she's also asking, what can't I represent? What can't I say? The Alexievich book is notable for its ellipses, right? And what lives in that? What lives in those three dots? You know, so I think that they do go deep, but they also are, I think, humble in the face of what they can do.
Paul, I can think we are lucky readers, but your students are also lucky too. It's wonderful to hear from you.
Thank you so much, David.
Paul Segal writes on books for The New Yorker as of this month. And the recommendations she just shared are Svetlana Alexievich's book, The Unwomanly Face of War, Christina Sharp's In the Wake, and Lisa Krohn's one-woman play called 2.5-Minute Ride. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining us today. And I wanted to let you know that The New Yorker Festival is back October 4th through October 10th. We'll have a mix of virtual conversations and some outdoor events that are taking place in New York City with guests like Amy Schumer, Stanley Tucci, Jamaica Kincaid, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Dave Grohl, and many more. It'll be a fantastic festival. You can find out all about it at newyorker.com/festival.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Allison McAdam and Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.